This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Malaysia's fintech industry has seen significant growth over the last few years. Now with around 230 fintech companies at last count, with digital payments companies and e-wallets making up at least a third of that. More interesting though, we're slated to see digital banks come into play next year, with Bank Negara Malaysia accepting final bids till the end of the month. We've seen interest here from new players like Grab and Axiata Digital, but also, interestingly enough, legacy players like Sunway Berhad. So as the digital banking race heats up and fintech companies continue to grow in Malaysia, today I speak with Vincent Fong, editor of Fintech News Malaysia, and Karen Poa, president of the Fintech Association of Malaysia, for a deep dive into the workings and current situation in the fintech scene. To the both of you, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you, Roshan.
Thank you for having us, Roshan. Glad to be here.
So, Vincent, I want to start with you here because you actually put out a report, I think it was 2 months ago, about the state of fintech in Malaysia. And in that, in your opening remarks there, you said that Malaysia's fintech scene is reaching an inflection point of growth. Could you explain that to us? What's the inflection point we're looking at?
For sure. So, I think if you look at the numbers, all the reports from Bank Negara, all the reports from Securities Commission Malaysia, they all state that we are seeing an all-time high for digital adoption across the board, whether you're looking at e-payments, digital wallets, digital wealth kind of tools and whatnot. So a lot of these users are starting to embrace this kind of digital financial services. But even from our end as a media house, you know, when we first started in 2017, we used to hunt down founders to get stories, right? Nowadays, it's like there's so many stories. Honestly, we can barely keep up. There's so many interesting things that's happening in this space. Like you said, digital banking and a lot of new players and interesting players throwing their hat in the ring. I think our last report, we probably had over 170 players. Now there's 230 plus players. And almost every week, we are hearing new and new players from other markets entering the scene, local players starting up something new. So it's getting really exciting over here, really.
Right. And Karen, as you look at the scene right now, what are the hot topics right now that the association is paying attention to and you're seeing a lot of buzz around?
I think what we can see is like financial services have matured a great deal over the past 10 years, right? And we have always on the lookout for future innovation and then consolidation within the industry. So you can look at how like banks were to financial services customers, to what supermarkets are to grocery shoppers. Nearly all available services and products, from mortgages to wealth management to cash transfer, could be found at your local bank. Dulu, okay? So we rarely compare services or prices, right? We trusted and relied on our local bank. But today, you can get financial services from our members, for example, WealthTech or Intelligent Wealth Management Platform from StashAway, Rise, or MyTio, or getting insurance without seeing an agent all through your phone with an insurtech company like Policy Street or FiLife, right? So what is thriving and what we're looking at is the development of e-wallet. E-wallet is thriving, like the top players, they metaverse themselves into other services from payments to lending and possibly digital bank now, right? So the fastest growth sector that we hear could possibly be the adoption by senior citizens or switching to digital banking platform due to what the situations that we are in. And then migrant workers adopting fintech solutions because they need to survive and then their home country needs to survive from the salary that they are getting. And then also digitalization of supply chain. So what I've experienced is that economies won't recover until the small businesses recover. So hence we feel like more bigger companies need to invest in their communities. And then businesses will remain disconnected from the communities and payment system. They will see slower economy recovery from the pandemic. So we have to onboard them on the financial services. If I can move on to give an example, like when the government gave out the 50 ringgit to the e-wallets, through the e-wallets, the people in the city area are very happy with the amount of money, but you will see people outside of the urban area having difficulty finding a merchant to spend their money on. So this is the infrastructure and the first and last mile gap that we need to close.
Right. So these are some of the key concerns, right? In the day, there is a certain romanticism around digital accessibility. But at the same time, there is also hurdles to digital accessibility, as we're seeing with rural areas, remote areas, whether it's digital learning or in fact, the e-wallet situation. But that's it, though, Karen. While it's nice to talk about fintech, also 233 players is a lot of companies. Do you think, at least from your perspective here, or what's talked among your maybe your association members, is consolidation something that they're starting to talk about? Is that something that's being seen?
Not from our members, because we are all still young and fast and fury type, right? Yeah. But I think the collaboration with the incumbents needs to happen. And that's where the existence of the association happens. So as an association, we are not policymaker or economic driver. We are here to connect, collaborate, and catalyze discussions amongst the incumbents and the fintech players.
Just to add to the whole conversation on whether or not consolidation is possible, and there are some segments where I think we see more heavy activities versus others, and some segments where there are clear leaders and there are clear laggards, right? So if we look at the equity crowdfunding space, I think there are a couple of players who are not really performing as well. In P2P, also, there are some clear leaders as well. In e-wallets, there are some clear leaders. So these are the few sub-segments that we anticipate in the next few years we might see some consolidation.
Karen, from the association's perspective, are there any concerns around funding at this point? I mean, we are seeing a lot of cheap money sloshing around. You know, interest rates are all-time lows. Big, giant investors, SPACs, are all looking for places to put their money to work. Any concerns from the association's perspective?
I think from our observations and discussions with the members, what we need is to get some spotlight on the services that they are offering, and then to get access, market access outside of Malaysia. So yes, we are like in between. We are not too big and not too small. so it's like... market access is actually the biggest issue when it comes to the fintech. And then how do you then achieve market access? It's actually just more money. Yeah, they need the funding. So when we speak to foreign investors who might be looking at investing in fintech companies, it's like, please do come to Malaysia. Almost everyone speaks English. We have very good tech talent, and we are one third cheaper than our neighbor. So,
Vincent, what are some of the bottlenecks you see in the funding landscape?
So I'm no expert in the funding scene, but just based on my observation is that if you look at the local VCs, they're mostly from seed stage to Series A, right? Not many of them are participating in the series, leading Series B rounds. So I think one of the struggles that we had is actually to attract more regional investors to come in to participate in these bigger rounds. But one thing that we're seeing the government doing to try to alleviate the situation is through the Penjana Capital. And from what we've heard, there's some interesting rounds coming up. So we're keeping an eye open on what's going to happen in that space.
I've been speaking with Vincent Fong, editor of FinTech News Malaysia, and Karen Powell, president of the FinTech Association of Malaysia. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. This morning, I'm speaking with Vincent Fong, editor of FinTech News Malaysia, and Karen Poa, president of the FinTech Association of Malaysia. So BNM and the Securities Commission are the main regulatory bodies that regulate fintech in the various subsectors here. Karen, has there been enough support and clarity from regulators as we strive towards a thriving fintech scene?
So when there is a new fintech startup that sometimes brainstorm ideas with a few of the industry players just to get a feel on whether their product is going to the right direction, we always tell them that innovation has to be responsible and sustainable. And you must foster trust among consumers and businesses. So your trust cannot be claimed and it has to be consistently earned, right? So between the financial institutions and the tech companies, they have a surplus of trust among consumers, but which they need to safeguard and grow. So best practices in the industry, yes. Consumer needs to be more vigilant themselves and do their own due diligence. So be smart about not sharing your personal information like your TAC or the OTP to strangers, right? So where regulators come in is like, yes, all the regulators are trying to up the game by relooking at policies that were issued like back in 2008, for example, the e-money framework that is recently being revived, and then looking at it again. And then we're seeing that, they are trying to catch up, and then the technology, and then also the scammers.
The e-money, the EMI is quite interesting. They recently brought up an exposure draft. Vincent, any thoughts on this or just the overall regulatory framework? Then we can dive into anything that you particularly pick up.
The e-money draft, one thing that we did observe, is an 80-page document, quite a read. And we think that one thing that's really good is that it provides a lot more clarity in certain areas in which the previous framework didn't address. I think one of the key things that is being looked at is the closed-loop e-wallets, right? So there's a lot more clarity in terms of the requirements and what is expected of them. But there were certain things that I think were of concern to the community, and I'm sure a lot of the members have brought it up to Karen as well, is that, that there's one particular segment that says that if you're a substantial e-money, a substantial shareholder in an eligible e-money institution, you cannot hold a senior management position. So I think some people within the startup community view that as a little bit anti-startup, because a lot of times the founders are the CEOs, right? So I'm sure this is something that will be brought out, and I'm sure Karen will discuss with her association, and they would voice some of this feedback to Bank Negara. But I certainly hope that's something that can be looked into. But just to quickly zoom back out and answer your question about the regulatory framework, I think for the most part, yes, it's quite pro-business. We have a lot of forward-looking policies from SC, you know, that enables a wide range of businesses like crowdfunding, P2P lending, robo-advisors, equity brokers. You know, you spoke a little bit about the digital bank earlier. If you look at the framework, the digital banking framework specifically, look at a foundational phase to enable smaller players to come in, right? And the foundational phase, the capital requirements only at 100 million. And I know a lot of people don't agree with me. They will say that's still too high. But in my view, if you can't raise 100 million, you shouldn't be a bank in this place.
Karen, when we take a look at the regulatory framework, whether it's the Securities Commission or BNM, the various sandboxes here, from the association's perspective, is it comprehensive enough or is it maybe too burdensome?
So the past 2 years have shown us the gap between the digital movers and the digital laggards. And it's not any easier to accelerate the digital transformation now than pre-COVID, right? As it involves a lot of challenges in legacy architecture, mindset and culture. So it's important to recognize that a huge part of the world is developing. And then the ability for us to use fintech to leapfrog will be the game changer. So yes, the regulatory framework is encouraging, I would think. It's low barrier to entry. Like, for example, the regulatory sandbox that we have, we're one of the first few in the world to launch it. And from there, you can see the innovativeness that is coming out from our homegrown brand. So I would think that the regulators are doing what they can, but with the utmost concern is to protect the consumers.
Is there anything on the regulatory wish list from your perspective?
Regulatory wish list. Okay, so we recognize that, and we've also made some changes in the sense of encouraging and persuading to the regulators to have more meetups with the startups. Yeah, go to the ground and speak to the startups because we don't want to leave it too loose. Then they just go out of order, or if we tighten it, then they will perish, right? So where is the middle point? Yeah, so I think having regular meetups and discussions with the regulators would help greatly.
Right.
I'm going to open a can of worms here. In terms of regulation, I think one aspect that I feel should be looked into is on the cryptocurrency exchanges. Mm-hmm. So currently we have 3 licensed exchanges, and I think they can only trade 3 or 4 different digital assets, right? I really think that the regulator should look at opening up a bigger basket of digital assets so that more and more people can trade on this licensed exchanges, because I think it's a big disadvantage for them to not be able to trade on some of these digital assets that is available on the unregulated platforms.
How does Malaysia's regulatory framework compare with other nations, be it Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, or even Vietnam? Because all of these essentially are essentially competitors for talent and funding with us. Any thoughts on how what we can learn from other countries?
So I think we have, in a way, learned from other countries, particularly if you look at the digital banking framework. It has a foundational phase, much like Australia. The capital requirements are reminiscent of the framework in Hong Kong as well. But I think one challenge that one narrative that we always see people talk about is that, country X is better, region X is better, we should follow this country, we should follow the country. Of course, there are a lot of elements that we can learn from a lot of these regulators as well. But the thing is, each of us are in very different, very unique kind of environments, and we have to apply the right kind of policy for the right kind of environment. So if you look, for example, in a country like Philippines, they are more open to digital banks that are startups, right? So we see two licenses from two startups, namely a company called Tonic and UnoBank. But their environment is a little bit different because they have thousands of islands, they have a very high unbanked population. So they have more room for non-systemically important banks, right? But in Malaysia, we have a different circumstance. Therefore, the banks need to operate at a different level and serve a different market. And the framework is designed around that kind of considerations. Then you look at certain kind of pieces of regulation like P2P lending. If you look at some countries, their P2P lending may be geared towards consumers. Our P2P lending is geared towards SMEs. As you correctly pointed out, you know, our household debt ratio is quite high, so it's not really ideal to do that. So yes, of course, there are things we should learn, but we shouldn't blindly say, oh, Europe is better, this country is better, that country is better. But having said that, I think we can definitely learn from Singapore and Hong Kong in terms of how we market ourselves as a hub.
Now, let's jump over to this very, very hot topic, digital banking in Malaysia. Getting quite a lot of news recently. I think it's probably because the deadline for the final bids are at the end of the month to BNM. RHB and Axiata announced that they've got a partnership there. There has also been reports about Sunway, YTL, and even Genting having some interest in getting a digital banking license. Bank Negara is expected to issue 5 licenses in the first quarter of 2022. Vincent, who do you think are the top contenders based on all the groundwork you've got right now?
I really don't want to be swallowing my own words in January.
Sure.
Or February. But there are certainly some strong contenders out there. Axiata and RHB certainly looks like a very strong proposition. There are some even more interesting ones that have yet to be officially announced. So I don't really want to speculate who will win this race. I think after the deadline is closed, we have a clearer picture. But for some reason, the players in Malaysia are a bit more coy in terms of announcing their bid. You know, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, everybody was like rushing and thumping their chest, like, oh, we're going to bid for this, we're going in with this. But so far in Malaysia, there's only a handful of people that have officially confirmed. Most of it's like sources and rumors and whatnot.
Right. So based on the official information that we have, who are the current contenders?
Official information, those who have publicly said are RHB, Axiata, Paramount Corporation, Razor, and then there was a South African digital bank called Time. It's about maybe 10 to 15 who have officially said that they are interested.
Karen, from the association's perspective or from your own observations, when we take a look at the digital banking scene, what are you guys paying attention to?
I think it will be the risk management. So if you look at the basic framework of the digital bank, in my opinion, okay, this is my opinion, I will break it down to the four quarters. So one quarter would be the branding. When you have the consortium, right, whose branding are we going to move forward with? So if you have an incumbent with very good database, very good consumer, but a very outdated brand, and then you partner with a young fintech, right? Whose branding are you gonna use, right? And then the second quarter would be the risk management. That is very important. Then the new fintech companies have the capability, and then the compliance costs and all that. And then the other quarter will be the distribution. You will want to have a company or a consortium that has got a very large database. Right. E-commerce is a good example. E-wallet is a good example. And then the last but not least would be the go-to-market strategy, how would then are you going to enforce the inclusivity? Because as far as Bank Negara is concerned, the digital bank must have, and most important is the inclusivity portion of it. And because of my current personal passion, is gender inclusivity as well. How do we look at things from the gender lens? Mm.
Right. And what are some of the key points that the association members have brought up in relation to digital banking?
Okay, the key points. Actually, they have been very quiet or hush-hush about all these discussions naturally, because if the bigger consortiums are public listed company, it will affect positively or negatively. So we have conducted two rounds of roundtable on this. We have, every time when we organize it, we have a lot of people that show up. It's quite shocking, like so many people are interested to apply, but it's always on a receiving mode. They will not share.
So just to add, right, just the other day, we completed a webinar session with Bank Negara Malaysia's director, and the way he classified the digital banks is into three categories, right? One is a specialist kind of digital bank where it's very tech and innovation focused. Two, it's ecosystem kind of play. Then you see guys like Grab, Shopee, who have their own existing ecosystem. And then three, you have a consortium kind of play, which is very prevalent, especially in the Hong Kong model of digital banks. So the way a lot of these banks position their brand moving forward, what we've seen in Hong Kong, where there's a lot of incumbent banks in the consortiums as well, you can see the branding is not really even linked to the bank. Like Livi Bank is not really linked to Bank of China. And then Mox Bank, they put their Mox by Standard Chartered. So I think it really depends on whether or not they feel adding that kind of incumbent brand name that adds trust to the whole branding.
So, Vincent, you mentioned the conversation with the BNM director, and if I got this correct, that was Suhaimi Ali, Director of Innovation and Development at Bank Negara Malaysia. And one particularly interesting point he brought up during your chat was about lobbying groups and asking them to respect the process. Was there anything else in that chat that we should be, I don't know, you want to bring to the surface?
No, I think Suhaimi is just sending a message out to the lobby groups to, you know, just follow the process. If you have a good value proposition, if you have a good business model, there's no need to lobby. And there's no reason to use your political influence or anything to grab a license and then not do anything with it. At the end of the day, there's only 5 licenses. We want to give it to the best players that can bring the best value for Malaysia. I also just want to quickly add on, I think one of the concerns, earlier you were asking about concerns in the digital banking framework. Some of the startups within the community are concerned that it'll be largely bank-led. And at the end of the day, it's just the same thing, right? It's just 5 licenses by 5 incumbent banks. That was some of the concern. But we did have the conversation with Suhaimi. He mentioned that there were a lot of very strong applications from non-banks. So there's a good chance that we will see a quite a balanced list by next year when they announce the full license. So I'm hopeful for that as well.
On that note, Vincent, Karen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation and definitely something I'll be paying attention to. Thank you both for your time. I've been speaking with Vincent Fong, editor of FinTech News Malaysia, and Karen Pua, president of the FinTech Association of Malaysia. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Karnison for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.